This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good evening. Art Sanctuary started because I was going out to book tours and was almost always in a place that was either a downtown or a university venue. And specifically, it hit me, and I was in Chicago. I was at Barbara's Books, right near where Hemingway had lived. And some people had taken two or three buses to get from the south side of Chicago to this bookstore. By the time they got there, it was raining. And by the time they got there, the reading was over. The bookstore was closing. And they'd had this book group. And I thought, whoa, well, wait a minute. I'm an African-American woman. I wrote this book about being an African-American woman. These African-American women came to hear me read this book. Why can't this happen in the middle of an inner city? Why can't this happen in a venue that they could get to without having to take the three buses? So I knew I couldn't do that, make a big impact on that in Chicago. We did stay late, by the way. I gave them a reading, their own reading, and I later found out I was very unhappy because the bookstore owner wanted to close it up. And she was very gruff about it. Later I found out that they had gotten a death threat and saying, if you let this person read, that we're going to come and we're going to shoot up your place. And, you know, why do you let these black people come? And do this? So clearly she didn't want to stay even later with, like, nothing but five black people in the store, you know. So, but all of these, you know, why do I bring race in? Because all of these are always affecting. They're always affecting the way that we receive art, the way we distribute it, the way we enjoy it. And I said, I can't do anything about that in Chicago. But right here where I live, maybe there's something else I could do about it. I also went to a place in Rochester, New York. Now, you can say in Rochester there's really nothing else to do because it's raining and it's always raining. But there were 500 people in a church listening to me talk, a not particularly well-known writer. They had signed up for this series. The series had a film writer, a script writer, and they had signed up for this series. They paid for it. They subscribed. And they were just coming to have an idea. I thought of how my grandparents used to go to the National Geographic series at the Academy of Music. You know, Pop-Up would sleep the whole time, but they went. They had a good time. It was all right, right? This is true. So I said, well, why don't we do this so that the core of the ideas are around the sort of African-American interests, even though that work, as we know, talks to everybody in America and sometimes also internationally. So let's do that. My mother told me, make sure if you do books to have something else with it so it's not too dry, you know. So we would open up. We would have a panel discussion, but we would open up with music. And the idea was to sort of soften the membrane, you know, and to bring in new people. All of us are here because all of us care about art. Part of what Art Sanctuary is trying to do is bring to this table people who otherwise would not come, and give them what they need to be part of that discussion. So if you have to have a free downloadable curriculum about Paul Washington and activism at the Church of the Advocate and Hannibal Lacumbe and jazz in New Orleans and what a trumpet is and how you improvise before people come to that this piece that we commissioned and enjoy it, then create the curriculum, talk to the teachers, get it into the schools, have people think about it, go to shelters, go to nursing homes, talk to people about this work, get a van from the senior home, get them, like, do all that work, so that then you get people there. Then they enjoy the art. You do not have to be specially trained to be affected by this mural, this mirror table. You don't have to be specially trained to be touched by Bill T. Jones dancing solo on the high altar of a French Gothic cathedral. But you do have to get in there. You have to be brought in. So I think that's what we do. This morning, we had a meeting with the Kimmel, some people from the Kimmel, who are partnering with us. This is just one example of a long, ongoing piece. Partnering with us on a piece that will premiere there in December of next year for their 10th anniversary. In advance of that, the piece is commissioned by Carol Hascovano. It's Hannibal Akumbe, who worked with us before. He is going to Philadelphia pretrial prison, a Philadelphia pretrial prison, once a month to create with these prisoners a pretrial, a band that he calls the Music Liberation Band. They write between his visits about, he talks about the door of no return. What door did you walk through in your life that you don't feel like you can go back through, that you have to go back through? You know, so he went there and he had these 12 grown men there crying and talking about what did they walk through that they were afraid to go back through. They write about it, and in 2 months they're going to get instruments and he's going to start a band, and he's using their work that they've written in his piece. That will be the spoken word, and the work that he has created will be sung. So that those are the kinds of things that we're working on.
Okay, so it's my turn. So there are many ways that I try to sometimes explain what we do at SLOT, but SLOT emerged in 2002 in Philadelphia, I guess out of a concern and at a moment when the cultural landscape seemed to be much more restrictive than it feels today. At that time, at least I had the sense that there was a very narrow definition of culture and of art playing out in Philadelphia, such that talking about social and political issues and trying to go beyond the traditional ways that art is defined and exhibited wasn't really possible. And so we wanted to create a space that would seem responsive to some of the other ways, some of the more expansive ways you could define what it means to be an artist. What I want to do is just kind of throw out three projects that maybe don't reflect how we began, but they reflect where we are right now. And then maybe that would be a very like kind of practical and tangible way to kind of explain some of the thinking that we're going through right now about what it means to be an artist, what it means to be active and engaged in a cultural community. One project that just opened a few weeks ago is a sound installation by John Cage. It's an unknown work. It's a work that's been previously unreleased. It's lost in the archives. And with the Cage Trust, we've installed it in perpetuity in a space that's, a young space, where usually things aren't installed in perpetuity. What we've done that's a bit different is we've invited the public to redefine the piece. And so the very understanding of what John Cage did in a piece from 1989 called How to Get Started, about the difficulty of being creative, the very definition of that piece, the very identity of that piece will evolve through the public's redefinition of it, through the public's reconstitution of it. So we've literally made an installation that's a recording studio. And you show up with your 10 thoughts, and your 10 thoughts are recorded, and they become very much part of the archive of what John Cage initiated. And so with that project, we're trying to argue that an artist's work doesn't begin and end with the artist. It's really kind of an idea that the artist launches and that is completed and very much engaged with by a public. So we're arguing in another sense that the public is also a performer. The public can also be a participant, that the artist isn't the only one who gets to play and gets to experiment. Another project that Mary had mentioned, the Perpetual Peace Project, started roughly a year ago out of a dissatisfaction that I think all of us at the table probably have with reading the newspaper every morning. Mm-hmm. And like many of the things we do at SLOT, we don't always know what we're getting into. We generally don't know what we're getting into. That's why we generally take on the projects that we do. I didn't come out of an international relations background. I don't know much about peace except my own personal convictions and feelings. But we wanted to see what we could learn and how we could share that process of learning with others. So we reached out to a variety of institutions and individuals statesmen, philosophers. At the end, we choreographed a variety of organizations to come together, ranging from the UN to the EU to universities and museums, to really rethink what it means to work towards a peaceful society at a moment when, at least in the kind of the international diplomacy community, you don't really use the word peace anymore. Peace has kind of completely fallen to the wayside. It's been replaced by words like security, words like conflict, which define the reality of most people that live on the surface of this earth. And so bringing that network of people together, that network of organizations together, we start to organize a variety of projects. And these have ranged from exhibitions, we have one at the New Museum right now, to a conference 3 weeks ago at the United Nations with ambassadors, defense ministers, and philosophers at a table just like this, to workshops in Lahore, Pakistan, this past week in China and Beijing, that really just seek to explore what peace could mean, not trying to impose a definition. And I don't mean to be long-winded, but simply to suggest that for us, thinking about peace is not antithetical to what a cultural organization should do. It's precisely what a cultural organization should do. It's not just a process. A curatorial process is not one where you just show things on the wall. It's really where you think, and you think with others. And you try to implicate each other. You try to be entangled in other people's definitions of what peace might mean, for instance. So, for instance, in Beijing last week, we played the recordings from Lahore, from Pakistan. And then the recordings and the material that were generated in Beijing will be used in Tijuana in January. And so we try to create like a conversation across cultural divides and differences. And then the third and final project, I'll try and be quick, is a project that in a certain sense ended this past year. It's called Into the Open. It was a project that we had the last minute chance to do in Venice at the Venice Biennale in the United States Pavilion to represent the United States. And what we proposed and did was we tried to represent America in a different way that it sometimes sees itself. And we worked with a lot of nonprofits throughout the United States, artists and architects that each often in their own way are trying to redefine what it means to be an architect and what it means to be an artist by working with communities very intimately. And whether that was in Tijuana, whether that was in Bed-Stuy, whether it was in rural Alabama, we were really interested in the ways that individuals can single-handedly try to mitigate the severity of disinvestment, which all of our communities and societies are familiar with. It was a difficult project, but it was also a project which is also emblematic of what we're trying to do these days, maybe not when we began. It's an initiative, which is to say we're very concerned that exhibitions open and close within 30 days these days, and we want to introduce another way of thinking about art that doesn't end 30 days after it opens. And so there's a project that's ongoing. It came to Philadelphia at the Constitution Center, and the city itself was a site of the exhibition. And now we're in a really difficult and interesting phase where we're trying to, with People's Emergency Center, with an architect, Teddy Cruz, from San Diego and Tijuana, we're trying to kind of see what it is possible to do in a neighborhood like Mancha, which historically doesn't have a lot of cultural organizations, which tends to have more social service organizations. A neighborhood which has had such a kind of historical role in Philadelphia, but which has also been very much marked by disinvestment. And we're trying to see how we could, in a way, not create another cultural infrastructure of a traditional sort, but one that would join everything from kind of urban farmers with kind of job employment offices, with digital inclusion programs, with ethnographic kind of initiatives. And so that's, again, another example of kind of one of these larger projects. So at their simplest, there's this idea that we have a very expanded definition of what it means to practice, what it means to be embedded in a cultural community. And for us, it's a very conceptual thing. We're not interested in defining the role of the artist. We're interested in proposing and supporting different models. And maybe one of the things that Lorraine and I can talk about tonight is questions of sustainability. We've often been focused on our programs, and our programs are so crucial to us, and they're also crucial to Lorraine, but one of the things that we've often talked about is the need for kind of a black institution that would be sustainable. And so there's different ways that we each think about what we're doing. In relationship to Pistoletto, though, since we're at Pistoletto's table, and it's a mirror table, The one last thing that I'll say is that Pistoletto's work is interesting to me, in particular insofar as we can't help but read ourselves into it. We're often reflected in it. The mirror works that are against the wall or even this table are kind of reflective surfaces. And so for me, the way that I think about that work is that you're kind of forced to, you're implicated by the work. You see yourself in it, but you also see others in it. And so that's something that I really am quite fascinated and taken by, the way that art is a vehicle to be implicated by other people's ideas and thinking and to be entangled with other people in a community. So anyway, so that's what I'm going to say. And the one other thing that I'll say is, you know, Philadelphia has a long history of experimenting with social and collective forms of belonging. And although that's something that I would say is what we do at Slot, we experiment with different ways of bringing people together, different ways of being social and being part of a community and questioning communities and what they can be and what they can aspire to. This is something that is so, I think, unique actually to Philadelphia. And whether you look back at the American Philosophical Society, whether you look at the Barnes Foundation, there are experiments with institutionality that have been playing out in Philadelphia since before the country started. And so I think, in a way, that Philly is like the perfect site to be thinking about the social and to be thinking about community, because there's this rich history of experimenting always with these ideas in this city. So I'm going to stop there.
Do you want to do a question now?
Yeah.
I actually want to do a little call and response. I know the 45 minutes isn't up yet, but I want to just do a little call and response, too, because I want to know who in this room, who are practicing artists here in all kinds of different disciplines? Who are practicing artists? Come on, out yourselves. Yeah, there we are. And also, how many people work in art that's collective, that's communal, that as opposed to, yeah, right? Yeah. All right, good. And you'll tell us pretty soon who's having fun. Are you having fun? This is good to know, because sometimes we're not, and I just want to know what this group was, whether we had to have kind of a healing ceremony and all get in the center and do a laying on of hands and chant and stuff. Okay, but we can keep talking for a little bit and everybody's okay for a minute. All right, that's good. We'll start with a question.
Okay, I'll start with a question for you. I mean, we already have talked about this in the past, but can you share with us your thinking about why it was so important, however beautiful and how amazing the work that you're doing in North Philly is, to also kind of be embedded in South Philly now? Can you talk about that notion of being embedded both within a neighborhood, a community, but also being embedded within a series of neighborhoods and communities, as it seems with this kind of new building you very much are aspiring to be?
We've been citywide for a while. So we started, we're rooted in North Philly, which is a hard place to transplant into, right? Because North Philadelphia, you know, this one lady who was about 80 years old 20 years ago said to me, she said, Philadelphia is the most provincial place there is in the whole world. She said, it's worse than anything else. It's worse than like a Stendhal novel or anything. She said, it's like people move from North Philly to Germantown and they give them a goodbye party. It's true. It's terrible. So part of what we wanted to do was, yes, start in North Philadelphia and stay there and learn. And still, people say, well, you know, are you from North Philly originally? But definitely go citywide, because there was somebody recently, oh shucks, who was it, who was saying, we just had a grand opening of this new building. We had 12 events. We had like this mini arts festival. And I can't remember who said what at which event. It's totally a mush. But that's not acceptable. I'll think of it. It was somebody who was saying, aha, it was Valerie Gay, who's a soprano, who's also in development at Temple, who also has her own arts academy at her church. It started with a children's choir, now it's adults and children, and she teaches music in that way. She said that some of her children, this is a West Philadelphia choir, she talked about it being like an egg, that they're in there and they haven't poked their way through yet. She said some of them have not been to downtown institutions. She was talking about bringing them here, bringing them there. And our after-school children, it was a huge deal to take them from North Philly to the Clef Club. So we started having classes outside of Church the Advocate just to get them used to going to different places. When we partnered with the Kimmel for something else, this was the first time this whole group, we partnered with the Grants as parents, anybody in that group had been to the Kimmel Center, right? So we partnered with the Opera Company, and they have a whole chart of the city showing which schools in which zip codes are the schools that have never, where the children have never been to the opera. Where there are no music lessons, so all of these for us are makes it incredibly important to be citywide, to be north and south, because one of the things we wanted to bring excellent work into North Philly so that we don't always have this idea that, you know, the ice here is colder, right? And that, I mean, that's a phrase in the Black community, that their ice is colder, you know, because if you're making ice here at the art museum and we have this, we install this in Church of the Advocate. Well, if I go up to the art museum, that's where it really, you know, really is. Like, you know, there are people in this room who, you know, parla l'italiano, huh? You know, North Philly, anybody's talking Italian up there, that couldn't be real. So this idea that it's closer to real. We definitely wanted to bring fine work there and say this is a place that creates work. I mean, these are the people who created work song, blues, jazz, hip-hop. Out of these communities comes this work, but when it gets commercially acceptable, then the work goes out. And then you go down to, you know, you've got to go down to the Electric Factory to hear the Roots, even though, you know, they started in South or West Philly. So that's part of, we wanted to bring great work there, acknowledge it, but also get people going back and forth and see if we can pull people around a little bit.
It's interesting. I've often thought of Philadelphia as a city that's marked by many borders, but the borders aren't physical. They're mm-hmm. social, they're economic. Mm-hmm. When we had opened, one of our first projects was a naive but good project with pretty much most of the high schools and middle schools in West Philly. And we immediately came up against the problem that, you know, we were at 40th Street, we still are, which at that time was more interstitial. It wasn't really Penn territory as it is now. And we could not get students from 49th Street to come to 40th. Mm-mm. That was like an impassable border. Mm-hmm. And I think that Philadelphia may have changed in certain respects, but it's still that city where nine blocks can be kind of an enormous distance. It's not an enormous distance because of a geographic distance, but because of something else that happens as you cross those nine blocks. Like Mantua is seven blocks from us. Mm-hmm. And within a seven block kind of distance, you go from a 0% vacancy rate at 40th and Walnut to 60% under the poverty line in places, 20 to 40% vacancy rate. Mm-hmm. So like huge, huge changes taking place in just a matter of blocks. I guess I have a question related to that for you, another question.
You have to make people who come in sit next to Aaron.
Yeah, I'm not that scary.
You have to, the next person, because they were, they have to sit next to Aaron. And there'd be no excuses.
So I guess the question,
here we go.
You should join us.
She better watch this thing.
Oh, come on.
Because if anything's off the wall.
You know, at the new museum, where we have these events every week, we have three events this coming Thursday, the security guards are part of the discussion.
That's
because
nice.
At the new museum, there was a history, especially in the 70s, that everybody was at the table deciding what happened at that institution. And that idea that everybody that's part of an institution is responsible for that, the identity and the programs at that institution, is something that I think is quite crucial.
I'll see you next
Thank
year.
You.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you. So the question concerns change. And when I started Slot, when Slot was getting underway, I had a more maybe artistic or activist definition of change. I wanted to witness the change that I wanted the projects to usher forth. I wanted to.
When
kind
did
of
you start Slot?
2002. But I was like 24. I was 25.
You were a baby, yes.
And I wanted to somehow see the change kind of happening.
Right.
And now, especially after this peace project and learning how diplomats and others think, they think on the level of decades.
Yep.
And they say that you have to think about change on that level,
right.
Not on the level that you would, in a narcissistic way, like be there to witness it happening.
Right.
And so I tend to think that way now. And I guess I was wondering what you think when you hear this word change, and what's the temporality of change? How, yeah, I'll stop there.
Oh, I didn't know. You know, what I think about change, I think that that the first person who has to be changed is me. If I do a project and it hasn't affected me, then it's not useful. And so many people, when we are doing projects that are close to, hey, coming in? Come on. Just people just scooch over. There we go. Thank you. When there's change, when we talk about change, often we're talking about a change. I think many people want to see a change, but they want it a change that we can envision and control, right? This is our old thing we used to talk about. The bankers would come in and we'd have a project and they'd say, well, we want to see more. We want to see more. And we'd say, well, this project really, in order for it to be excellent, you can't do it with more than 15 children. And I'd say, for instance, my class at Penn is capped at 15. That's because they understand that I can't do an excellent job of teaching creative writing to 150 kids. They know that. And then I'd look at the banker and I'd say, you know that. Your child is where? Germantown Friends, perhaps? They don't have an app. They don't have a program. There's no way in hell your child... Oy, sorry, I won't curse anymore. You were so young, I didn't know before. There is no way whatsoever that program that banker's child would be in, that he would want the program that he wants to fund. So he wants to take our excellent program and for 15 kids and make it mediocre with 40 kids so that he can say, I have affected and, you know, affected transformation in these 40. You haven't. You haven't. You've done warehousing and given some chaos and let them know that they're not worth a good program, right? So for me, that all of that means change. It means for our organization, it was change in the way that everybody associated with us thought about getting money. It's not okay to take that money for those 40. Don't do it. Don't accept it. Don't say you know... 8 Negroes and 1 crayon. That's not okay. We're not going to accept the money for it. So do it some other way. Hump it. Figure it out. Put it in mom's house. Do it in the garage. Do something else. Take that much that you have. Get somebody to do pro bono. Get them to do it for 3 months. And then figure out how to... When a dear friend, Jenny Dietrich, died, I remember that someone said to me, in her honor, I'd like to give your organization something. And I don't quite know what it would be. And I said, I want you to give us money for group therapy for this bunch of kids because we tried a beautiful poetry project. We had a curriculum. Everything was great. We were so happy. We were so proud of ourselves. You know, the kids were in once, and then they were in twice, and then there was a fight, and then somebody took the poetry, they hit the other person with the book, and then it was FU and F poetry, and the hell, and that was, I've done it again. Anyway, so they did all that. There was a great big fight. And what they needed, and we had started the project for the grands, as parents, who said, our grandchildren are angry because their parents are dead, in jail, or on drugs. So what do you do? So you get in this room at the Church of the Advocate. You put 12 or 15 of these really angry kids whose parents are not there, who are being raised by 75-year-olds, who, we were told, lost their own kids, and now they have six kids under 12 at 75. Mom, are you down with that? No, nobody, this is too much, right? So the gift that she gave was, in Jenny's honor, she gave us money for a group therapist. And I said, the gift I want from you is that I don't have to write you an assessment. She said, no, just take it and do the therapy, because when I give therapy for my kids, I don't insist on a report back. And I asked that man, I said, tell us when they're ready for a project. And he said, go away, leave me alone, we're going to just have pizza and Coca-Cola, you know, three times a week and talk. 3 months later, he said, something very light, nothing with a pencil. And of course, you know, I want literacy, I want reading, I want them to read. I don't like the fact that we're talking for 3 months and they can't read. It's not okay. Chill out. So we did dance because they needed body, right? And they needed to work their grief, and the best way to work your grief is through your body, right? Because that's where you hold it. So we did this one project, we did dance. And then the next year we did some theater, mostly dance. It was 3 years before that group would write something. It was the fourth year before they would read publicly what they had written. Year five, they did a play. It was so talky. They just went on, and the teaching artists let them put every bad, 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 bad poem in that thing. It was just terrible. I had to leave. I left. I called my friend in California. I said, I'm walking outside. Just talk to me until this damn thing is over. Can't take it. They're talking too much. There's no beginning, middle, and end. The children, any poetry they throw up sticks on the wall. I know it's good for them, but I can't do it. So that the change took that long.
I have another question too, but then you're going to have to...
And then I'll shut up.
Then no. You're going to have to start answering, asking
and
the questions.
And then I have to ask you questions, yeah. Right.
So,
In fact, it's time for me to ask you a question now.
Okay.
I'll ask you a question?
Okay.
We asked questions. We you and I talk about money,
yeah.
And we talk about institution.
Yeah.
And we talk about, you know, my board member who says we have to get up to $1 million budget.
Yeah.
Then we'll get respect, we'll get visibility. You have to, you know, more. And you were saying that maybe that's not more money is not always better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, these are people here. They're all grown-ups. They're all trying to figure out how do you do the art? You have to pay for it. Talk to me some about you and money.
Well, I can't give you kind of a tidy answer. I can just give you kind of my own ambivalences. But, I'm going to deflect and think historically. I mean, traditionally, the role of the artist, the role of the avant-garde has been to experiment and to interrogate institutionality, to kind of resist, engage power, to engage, disengage. But also, traditionally, artists haven't necessarily been among the wealthiest in mm-hmm. society. So I think one of the things that artists are amazing at, and one of the things that small cultural organizations are amazing at, is gift economies. And in the case of Slot, I mean, maybe soon we'll get to that $1 million budget, but it's going to be a gift economy, like an in-kind kind of $1 million.
Yeah.
I don't know if our organization, as much as I would like to see it reach a certain sustainability, I don't know if it can transition to a hard calculus, a hard economic calculus. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I don't know. We put our programs first, and mm-hmm. we often ask partners not to give us money, but to give us their collaborative kind of spirit, to give their mm-hmm. an institutional engagement or embrace of the project, and that mm-hmm. to us. Not that it makes it easy to do what we want to do, but that to us is more valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I mean, I just think very differently about
mm-hmm.
money. I don't see it as something that's inherently constructive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got a a large grant, or for us a large grant of $30,000. That's very large for us, and for this John Cage project. And it's played out beautifully, but getting the grant was actually one of the most difficult things for the project. Everybody wanted to be paid something that previously the project wasn't about for them. It was very hard to figure out how to reimburse them for what they were actually putting in on a monetary level. It was very easy to create kind of a collaborative ethos in the gift economy when money wasn't at the table. That doesn't mean it's easy to meet the overhead and all of that, but we try to not make money be the basis for our projects. When we undertake a project, when the board agrees to a project, when I propose a project, regardless of whether we get the grant or not, we're committed to doing the project. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe that's a different way of mm-hmm. answering the question. Mm-hmm.
We will, in about a few minutes, we're to our 45 minutes. And it's no fun being in a room where the people are enjoying talking so much that they never shut up. That's not going to happen to you tonight. Okay, I promise you. So we're just...
I disagree. I think, like...
yeah, come on. Yeah. Come on. This is why it's good we talk.
This past week in Hong Kong we did, and in Beijing we did these workshops with students, with artists, with architects, with mm-hmm. just members of the public that had responded to mm-hmm. these workshop announcements. And a lot of them said that what we've lost today is an art of listening, and that an art of listening would be... for them, a way towards a more peaceful understanding of each other and of exchange and of cultural understanding. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't open this up, but I'm saying that there's something really crucial that's been lost today, which is not just talking, but listening. So my question...
Sorry. Yes, your question.
For you is, can you force a dialogue before it's time? I often think that in a way, that's one of the ways I think about what the role of an artist is, or what the role of an arts organization is, right? To create a space for a dialogue, to sometimes force it in a provocative manner. Can you force a dialogue before society is ready? Do you feel like that's exactly what you're trying to do?
I think that's what art does all the time. And I think, who was it? Who was the man? Was it Friedmeier? Friedmeier, something like that. He was head of the NEA for about a minute and a half.
Half an hour.
And one of the things he said that art, and this is part of one of the reasons why I guess I got, he said that art has to, as one of its roles, is to put in front of society the kinds of ideas that we're not yet ready to deal with politically. That we, you know, when we're politically, we fight it out, we monetize it, we put power behind it, and we try to force our views. You know, I want this about tax, you want that about tax, and we're going to fight politically so that what I want gets done over what you want, or else we compromise so that I get most of my, or whatever, right? But he said art can do things way ahead of it. And when he said that, you know, my first thought was sitting in the Yaden Library reading Giovanni's Room by Baldwin when, because a girl I liked very much, this is not why I read it, but when I read it I understood that there was a girl who was a very good friend of mine who was a lesbian. And as I was reading this book, Baldwin... In his world, she could be regularized. As long as I was reading that book, it was okay with me. But I had to go into that book because in the world we were in, it wasn't. Do you know what I mean? So I knew that book, and my God, the book was written way before I was born, even. So I needed the art to do that for me. I needed it to make me more courageous as a human being so that I could have my friendship with her, period. Because really, the world I was in, I may have been going to high school there, but really I was trying to be in Baldwin's world. So I think the art itself does it. And I think cultural organizations sometimes can, if they're courageous enough. But I think we definitely have to try. And when we fail to, when we just are safe, then we're not doing art anymore. We're doing entertainment. And that is actually easier to put into a market economy.
Kind of a related question. You're a writer, you're a novelist, and so language to you has a power and has a force. Can anything be communicated, or are there certain things that can't be translated across various borders, various cultures? I don't just mean globally, like the work that I've been doing in Pakistan and China, but when we've talked about some of the issues that North Philadelphians face that you've been working with, can that be understood in Center City?
Can anything be communicated? You always ask these questions, and I want to go home and write about it for a week, and then come back and talk. I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know.
I mean, are you ever marked by ambivalence? I guess, or is that just not your ethos? Like, do you ever wonder if you're up, if you can pull it off? What are you laughing about?
She's never.
I know. Well, that's why.
What am I saying? I'm not ambivalent about anything.
Never.
Well, no, I don't know if that's true. I do know that. So there are two. The person who runs Art Sanctuary is here tonight, right? She put on lipstick. She put on these are not really heels, but they're proper shoes, and you know, right? And I got mom, and we came out together, and we've driven here. I didn't come on my bike. You know, I'm wearing a bra. Everything is like as it should be. The artist doesn't do all those things. So tonight, so can I force a conversation? Yeah, if I'm answering from the Art Sanctuary head, then I would say that we must try. Blah, blah, blah. As an artist, I've got to believe everything can be communicated. But I must say, as somebody who administers programs, that one of the hardest things is to communicate across experience. That's the hardest thing, is to communicate across experience. So we had a woman who's written her first novel, who was being interviewed by a TV anchor at one of our events this week. And the question from the anchor was, you know, so many things, you know, I start to wonder, when you're creating, you made so many things happen to this family. One starts to wonder, could one family have all these things happen?
Oh, God.
Whoa. See this line here? We only had like 20 people, and it was very like intimate. We had a class divide when she asked that question. You know, it's like when so things can be communicated, yes. But I know as a writer, I can't always communicate given my medium and given the person who comes to the medium ready to enjoy it. You know, I write nonfiction, I write novels. A novel is a form that came really into its glory in the 19th century. Novels are about money and fertility. Novels are about, that's what they're about, right? Who is inheriting what, how many, you know, she has a living of, you know, £10,000 a year, but then she's going to lose it because so-and-so, and of course if she marries so-and-so, then she'll lose that, and there's only £2,000 per year. Of course that she does love him, and then they're not able to have children. But perhaps she'll look over to so-and-so, who's much better suited. And this is what a novel is about. This is the, so I take this medium, right? And I'm trying to figure out what to do with this medium. And I'm trying to communicate something. So if I write a book about a woman who's enslaved, it means that her social status is lower than anybody who can read. If you can read this, your social status is. So how do I get you to understand her worth when she does not own her own labor? There's a chair right up here. that you can have. It's very comfortable.
They may be,
if you like it.
They may be passing by.
That's okay. They might want to come in. If they want to come in.
Then they're not.
Yeah, if they're two, let's see. They can put a ball. Yeah. Good.
They have three.
Don't push them out. They're trying to have an evening together. So I'm trying to communicate something that I haven't experienced, that it's taken me 3 years to get the courage to do, because I'm going to write about slavery. I've had three squares every day. Look at me. I've never been enslaved, you know. But is this important? Do I try to get there in some way or other? Yes. Are we communicating normally? No. Because when I try to talk to a funder about something that we're doing and why it takes this much to do this kind of marketing and why I have to get Brother Preston to go out and talk to people right up in their faces, is because my funder does not imagine that I want to have 30% of these people coming to this thing who have no telephone. So, and just, I say that, but then does that get into his or her, what that person's life is like? I haven't communicated that. So as the artist, I try to communicate. First, I try to learn it to myself. But meanwhile, I'm trying to communicate to my own self. I've been married to a man for 27 years, and I write a male character. I've been sleeping in the same bed with a man for 27 years. I write a male character. I give it to him. I say, read it. He says to me, it sounds like a woman with a penis. But communicating, I mean, he's been communicating to me for a long time what it's like to be a man, and 27 years I write that woman with a penis. That's not good. So I still have to learn some more. So I have to listen some more. Can we communicate anything? I don't know. I'm so busy trying to get my own self communicated to and monitorize some of it so that I can get some programs, because I do like to pay people. So
I don't mean to quote your own words back to you, but before you kind of seemed to be constructing a border or a line between yourself as an artist.
Yes, I do.
And yourself as an administrator.
Yes, I do.
But how can you construct that line? Because isn't your administrative work precisely also something that's very creative and very inventive? Isn't Art Sanctuary an artwork? Like, how can you construct these borders? Why would you want to, or do you feel you have to?
Because I am not free at Art Sanctuary. I have to work for the organization. I can't write stuff that pisses people off. I can't do that. Because I do have payroll every 2 weeks. And because I grew up in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which Richard Allen built by dragging a blacksmith shop over to 6th and Lombard to the land that's been held for the longest of any land that's in black hands in America. I learned about building an institution because I was in an institution that somebody built. I got scholarships because somebody put money in an endowment and said, give this to kids. I have been the recipient of so many gifts that I feel like I have to build it to leave that for somebody. In order to build it, however, I have to do it in such a way that that is not about me, that is about this organization. And I have the bit in my mouth and I pull the plow. It's very different from being the artist. Luckily, the novel that I wanted to write this time is a novel that I can write and it still is okay. People will read it and they will not say, gee, God. Or like, you know, so I'm a clergy wife, by the way. And sometimes people read my stuff and they say, whoa,
Jesus.
Whoa, she's teaching my children about coming to the Lord. Whoa. You know, so I'm not going to be in this forever. I want to create this organization. I want it to walk away. I want it to be good. I want it to be useful. I want all those 10,000 people a year who get something from us to become 20,000, and I want them to get more. And for all these people who come in to learn, you know, every organization deals with its stuff. We have lots. We're always dealing with black self-hate. I've had people in, I've had to fire people because they come in and they do not want our organization to be fabulous. Because if you're black in America, it sort of means that, you know, if you're with down with the people, you're good, you're fine, but you're a loser if you're not getting much. If you're not getting paid, you're a loser. If you're doing really well, you must be a sellout. Whoa, how do you do success? How do you do success? If I write letters and I say, we need the money very badly for these kids, and people say, God, I just wish, you know, oh, I wish you guys would figure out a way so that you could be self-sustaining. And if I write the letter that says we're doing really great, and I just wrote one today saying we want to put a solar panel on top of our new building, and, you know, I emailed it to a couple of people who read it first of all, and they say, aren't you getting a little big for your britches? Do you need solar? Yes, we need solar! Yeah, we need electricity like everybody else. So negotiating, you know, all these things is where our life is. And I would like to be able to write an article where I say something I want and people could say, oh, that terrible woman. God, like, I can't do that now.
From the outside, you know, from the outside, I think of Art Sanctuary as something, I mean, I know these struggles, and we've talked about them late at night, very late at night, but I don't know, I think of Art Sanctuary as something that's precious, something that's beautiful, something that's an artwork in its
yes.
own way.
Yes,
but that's
it is.
Not the way, I mean, you're saying that, but that's not really the way that you think of it. That's just a different way of thinking about Art Sanctuary.
It is a work. It is art. Our dear composer, trumpeter, Hannibal Lacumbe, is always telling me, he says, sis, he calls up. From where he is, by the way, after having driven his pickup, dumped his load of chicken manure on his farm, and now going out and where music is coming into his head, and he starts singing things on the phone to me. He says, sis, you know, Art Sanctuary, that's a beautiful book you're writing, sis. I just want you to know that's a beautiful book. And I'll say thank you. And then he wants to read me, and then he reads me some of his poetry, and it's wonderful. And meanwhile, what am I doing? You know, meanwhile, I'm sort of looking, the email's coming in like this about, you know, what. Yes, it is. It is art. There's a lot to it that's art. But I've had to learn business, really, which is fine. I love learning about business. I've learned a lot. I don't think I could be. I didn't feel it was okay anymore. I didn't feel it was okay anymore just to write about stuff in a way that sometimes writers do, and they say, okay, I've got ideas about all this kind of stuff, about what's wrong with the rest of the world, and the way. Why don't you and him go fight? Why don't you go do something about art in the world? It wasn't okay. I wanted to put my penny in the pot and say, could I do it? I wanted to be a grown-up with this, right? And instead of coming home saying, Mom and Dad, why don't we have oxtails? Well, we don't have oxtails because they cost $6 a pound. Why don't you make some money and go buy some oxtails and be a grown-up? So that's what I felt like I needed to do. And is it artwork? Yes. Am I learning? Yes. Is it a creation? Absolutely. I'm very grateful for it. Am I free like an artist? Because we're always negotiating between the artist, the person who's in there, like the child, like just creating stuff. Whee! Woo! You know, that person versus the person who, you know, the critic who comes in and says, well, really, that paragraph is not funny. You know, I have both people in me because I got to create the stuff, and then, thank God, I have the critic who says, not that. Paragraph.
See, I don't think of an artist as free. I think of an artist as more chained than anybody else. And like in Beijing, I spent some time with an artist, Huan Rei, who, after as the Cultural Revolution was ending, He was one of the first artists in the STARS movement to create contemporary art there. And he, every day of his life, like, feels and bears the burden of societal tensions and problems and the restrictions that are there in China. And everywhere I look, the artist has it, it seems to me, the most difficult of all. They're not in any way free. Creativity is so torturous, actually, and difficult. That's what John Cage was saying with this How to Get Started project, that it, like, 3 years before he died, the most difficult thing for him was to be creative. It wasn't just like an improvisation, as we often think of him and his work being. But I don't know, there's an essay I've been thinking a lot about lately and writing about, an essay by Adorno on culture and administration. He says we've done a disservice to ourselves because we've divided culture and administration. And there's something, when I look at your work, that's fundamentally creative about administration, even though that may not be the creativity that you associate with the art of writing. So I don't know, I kind of...
It's a different pleasure.
Yeah.
They are very different pleasures. And I don't, I mean, I can't say theoretically, administration, art, but I don't want to put boundaries, blah, blah, blah. I do put boundaries because I know the pleasures are very different. It's the difference for me between, cooking a meal. I love to cook. I love to experiment. I love to grow things and all that. But, you know, when the whole church is coming over for dinner, that's a different deal. You know, you're throwing down, there's going to be 65 people in there, and you got to make it right, and it's got to be this, and it's that much hot, and this people can't eat this, and it's a different deal.
I mean, I know there's going to be a conversation
in
a few weeks here with Feast, and I know that NATO is here, and many are at the table that are trying to make food be something that has a more central role.
Steak.
That food needs to have a more central role in our lives. One of the things we've been doing in the last few months is almost every program that we've been undertaking has a dinner associated with it. The conversation, the event, whether it's somewhere far from Philadelphia or in Philadelphia, the conversation happens over food. You know, trying to make a more intimate form of program come about.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know I've been talking too long. Laureen wants to open it up. I want to open it up. Does anybody want to jump in?
But you have to put it to your mouth, though.
Okay. when you talk about the need...
Will you tell your name so everybody knows?
I'm Bill Madeira. And I have lots of affinities, but I also work with the Kaja Project. What you're talking about is the need for, and mostly this is about kids, individual growth and development. And the possibilities of social change. And it seems to me there's an inherent clash with the ability to sustain these programs for long enough to create the kind of change that we all want. And you spoke very movingly about the two sides of your personality. And I wonder if it isn't maybe time for all of us to go and visit the big foundation and say, you're causing more trouble than you're worth. You know, the requirements that you put on us are such that we can't possibly take the time to do what we want to and to affect the change we need. And it's easy because I'm not getting funded. I mean, I'm involved with this small nonprofit in Germantown, and we finally said to Pew, you know what? We don't have time to apply for a grant from you. You know, you take up too much time. So I wonder if either you could...
That's why we never got a Pew.
I wonder if the two of you who go out and look for money have any suggestions about how people can get money to sustain programs for as long as they need to be sustained?
One way is your way, actually, is to find a way to do it to that it's not all dependent on money. That's for sure. Another way is we try to find ways to take the project, build a model, and then connect it to some funding source or have it absorbed into something. So, for instance, there's a woman who is our managing director. She started a program in Selma, Alabama called Just Be, and it was for middle school girls, and she took into account the fact that so many of them had been sexually abused. We hear the numbers, but we don't act accordingly. So, you know, 1 out of 4 was the number given of girls in that community were likely to have been in some way or other sexually abused or assaulted. The program takes that into account. It's about girls and body image and assertion and being strong and that kind of stuff. And there are lots of elements to it. There's some leadership, some physical sport. For girls who don't take sports, there's strength training, there's all this other stuff. It was a social service. After a while, doing it for about 3 years, she worked to have it put into the school system as a requirement in middle school for girls. In that way, it is now funded publicly, and it has grown to scale. That's some of what we're thinking about. I think that's some of what partnership is about, some of what figuring out how to lodge these programs in different places and share the funding and figure out what in-kind can be brought regularly that people would normally do. So you work with a church, there's always the in-kind of the members of the church who do blah, blah, blah. You work with school systems, with other, that's sort of what we do. I think that's what we do. I can't go to organizations that have funded us and have been really very generous and say you're more trouble than you're worth to them. But we do have to keep being super, super creative about how to get new money. So we've done our program now for 10 years. We can see some change over that time. I guess the change that I see is making nonprofit people figure out how to continue to get money, to keep their eye on the ball and do that. Why is it useful? I think it's useful because I think there are people who come through who are better able to live in the economy we have and make money and figure out how to do money. And we're doing Zumba classes, by the way. They're $10 a piece if you'd like to come. It's great fun. Every Wednesday afternoon.
And what's that on the back of your shirt?
So bomber's back?
I mean, there were two parts to your question in a way. The question of sustainability mm-hmm. in a way. And then the question of kind of the foundation, the management landscape that we've entered ourselves, that we're embedded in. With regards to the first question, I wish that we were a social services organization. I wish we could somehow like get there, we could become that, but we're not. Our skill is to launch models and experiments, not to sustain them usually. I wish that we could, but that's not who we are, and that's why we're now increasingly working with social service organizations that are good at that. In response to the second question, I don't know. I mean, I wake up every day wanting the funding climate to be different than it is. But the funding climate matches the society that we're part of. It's not accidental that this logic of accountability and of conservatism has kind of played itself out in the funding world. I don't know. I think when I wake up, I'm upset. I want that to not be the way it is, not just for ourselves, but for others. But at the same time, I also feel like we're really rich as an organization because of that social infrastructure, that network. So you find
the network of you and the social service agencies?
Of the people that are part of the organization, the people that we work with. There are other ways to define wealth, and it doesn't have to only be dependent on that which you don't have and that which somebody else has and isn't giving you. As much as I want that funding landscape to be different, I don't know that it's going to be different anytime soon. And oddly enough, like in China this past week, had a really interesting conversation. I said, like, to this artist, wondering, I said, do you engage or do you disengage? And he said, I don't have that option. Like, there are no foundations here. I only have the option of working with the government or working with some gallery, and both are completely problematic to what I believe in. And so he said, I don't have that luxury of, like, not engaging or of engaging. He can't even have that luxury of thinking that way. So I don't know. I wish the landscape was different. I wish it was easier to raise money, but it's not going to change anytime soon. That's just the way it is. So, sorry.
Anybody can ask. You want to ask a question?
I want to ask a question. Oh. I just wanted to know if you and Lorraine started organizations that have almost the same goal, or similar, but on the same level,
put to your
on
mouth.
The same plane, on the same level. Did you start out that way? Because she needed money, but you sounded as though you didn't need money to start.
No, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm not going to answer your question. We needed money, I just didn't know how to get it. And if I knew what I was getting into, I wouldn't have started the organization. The whole point is that you only go in naive. You know? Like, I didn't, you know, like, it's the story of most nonprofits, you know, of a small scale. You know, you don't know what you're getting into. You learn as you're going.
It's like marriage. You just sort of do it. And everything, and then you said, whoa, no.
And every year you're still learning. Like, you know, we had to do our first audit last year and our second one this year. And it's a sign that we've grown, that, you know, we have more money that's coming in. But I didn't know what that meant. I should have known after 7 years. But you're always learning. You're perpetually learning, just as the public is perpetually learning.
I think sometimes that you're not on the same level. Yeah. And you have a different, excuse the expression, like the Democrats and the Republicans. You have your base, which is totally different than her base. And so you might have started out similarly, but you don't have the same whatever the juices that she has to work a whole 6 months for grants. Mm-hmm. And you don't sound like
No,
that.
We do that too. I mean, Megan, who's sitting over there, can attest to that. We're there at 1 a.m, we're there at 5 a.m. We have our financial pressures, but I don't talk about those things. I don't want to talk about those things. I wish it were easy. I wish that I didn't, like, for the first 4 years of our organization, I slept in an office because I couldn't pay the rent for an organization. We were a small nonprofit. We had no grants. I couldn't afford an apartment and afford to pay the rent for the organization. So
that's why we always saw each other.
I know. So I slept on the equivalent of like two of these chairs for like 4 years of my life. Like I do not like I have a sadness about those 4 years of my life that I don't talk about to anybody. But that's the history of the organization too. But it doesn't enable me to do the projects I want to do when I talk that way. But there's history.
We should let somebody else do a question. We should.
Erin, I want to ask you a question. You were talking earlier about how the biggest barriers in Philadelphia are the social barriers, or the geographical one. And I think that one of the biggest barriers out there is the one that exists at the gallery door. It's the barrier that says, if you don't have the kind of cultural capital, then you might as well not come in. What have you done, and what have you seen done to overcome that?
It's a good question. I don't think we've done a particularly good job of responding to that problem. It's in a certain sense, I feel like we spent the last 2-3 years researching and learning from other models with an eye towards, in the coming year or two, trying to make some substantive changes to how we interface with others, how we meet the street. I don't know. We thought when we opened that it would be an easy issue to broach, and it became a very complicated one. In a certain sense, I kind of feel like we have to give up our space and start over, that the architecture of a storefront space is really limited. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think in an emblematic way for us, we've just been like studying other models, and we're trying to synthesize all these models in that project in Mantua.
Right, and you were talking about the project in Mantua. Is that an outgrowth of of your quest to overcome that problem? Mm-hmm. And if so, what are some of the precedents that you're drawing on?
I mean, I guess that project is an attempt to, in a way, give up the gallery space that we currently have that limits us to thinking about a cultural initiative as in the form of an exhibition. And so fundamentally, that's a project where we are in partnership with an architect, with community organizations, with a social services organization. And so it transforms our very understanding of what a program would be. So again, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but in a certain sense, I don't know how much we can push up against the model that we've inhabited in the past years. I feel like we have to almost start over. The Into the Open show, the show in Venice, was for me a research initiative to learn what's happening throughout the United States, what models exist that could be that we can learn from, that we can learn from and apply here. Nada.
And a building just building up kind of on that same question about audience for both your institutions, organizations. Talking about race, class, I was just thinking about what would it mean for art sanctuary audience to try to attend Aaron's nerdy youth projects for like years. And then simultaneously for your, audience to go to art sanctuary for a year. Just so it's actually not an accusation at all. I just think that there's in terms of cross-race, cross-disciplinary programming and audience, I wonder if you guys could just flesh out where you feel that there's some frustrations of pushing past those, or where you feel it's comfortable, where you want to work on. Certainly you've indicated some interest in that area, and I was interested in your, I know you guys have such a direct mission in Art Sanctuary. Do you feel kind of parts you want to push further in terms of audience, or how do you guys think about that? And also, would you see your institutions collaborating, or would that be just too weird?
No, it wouldn't be too weird. For us, the art is African-American, Afro-Caribbean, or African, but the audience can be anybody. So we know, all of us consume African-American art. So our audiences vary incredibly depending upon the event. And as I said, the reason we did these 12 different events was to do this diversity. So it was anything from a soprano singing spirituals to Jerry Lynn Johnson with four musicians from her chamber orchestra teaching people how she conducts European chamber music, to capoeira, to a writer, to spoken word open mic, to a hip-hop group, to jazz. So given that, you see all the different kind of audiences we had. And some of our audiences were 40% European-American. Some of them had nobody who was European. It really depends upon the work. One of the most enjoyable ones we did, which is actually the one where we met this Hannibal Lacombe, whom we're working with now, was a collaboration with Network for New Music. And the idea there was that they only do contemporary music, and most of their people are very sophisticated, total music lover. They're probably the musical equivalent of this audience tonight, right? I mean, you didn't come out here by mistake thinking you were coming to the club. I mean, you knew where you were coming, right? So we got music people, Network for New, but if they did a program of all African-American composers, their audience was likely to have gotten smaller. So by collaborating, we got, half of their people who said, honey, 18th and Diamond, let's get out the, okay, let's do it anyway, it's Network, let's go, they never let us wrong before. So we would get, the other half said, not this time, Linda. And our audience who said, what is this stuff? Who are these people? What is this? Well, it's Art Sanctuary, and it's good for me. I'm going to eat my Brussels sprouts. So they came out, too. And the mix was amazing. So that the thing Sonia Sanchez said is when you come to our event, sometimes you're sitting next to a pimp on one side and a professor on the other, and you don't know which is which.
But I think that's it, that you choose your programs. By choosing your programs, you decide on your audience. You know, and the Roots say, play the music the MFers want to hear. So that's sort of what you're doing. You play the, you do the work that people want to hear. Clearly you have, there's a lot of diversity here among us that we may not see, but these are all people who are interested in this whole community thing. That's why these people are here. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to respond to your question. I'm going to treat it almost like a provocation. I mean, there is one way of looking at, like, let's say what we do, and to look at it as a fairly kind of privileged discourse that's playing out. There's a lot that we do that doesn't take the form of programs. But fundamentally, I guess I just have a different way of thinking about culture and what constitutes the work of a cultural organization. And I tend to not think about privilege. I tend to, I don't know, look, in Kant's essay on peace, he really inaugurates a discourse about cosmopolitanism. And he says that we all inhabit one surface of the globe. We're one people with one collective belonging, regardless of nationality. And I guess we're at a table that also seeks to encompass that, despite the fact that there are these lines between the mirror plates. There's kind of a surface of the globe that we're sitting at. And I don't know, I tend to think not in terms of the fact that our projects are privileged by virtue of a certain intellectualism that's at the heart of them, but rather I think of the people every day for 8 years, every day I see and talk with my friends at the post office. They're half a block from Slot. I think that they are part of Slot. I go to their church. They know everything that's happening at Slot, and I think of them as part of the organization. In Lahore in Pakistan, I mean, yes, it's under the rubric of a peace project, but we were talking in ways that I wake up every morning and every day think about throughout the day. You know, one of the students, as you know, because I played that file at the Creative Time Summit, you know, this young woman is woken up in the middle of her night, in the night, by her parents because a bomb went off, and they want to know if she's still alive. Mm. And she's kind of immune to that. She's so used to that, she just goes right back to sleep. Mm. And those stories are also the kinds of things that our programs are always centered around. Maybe not the ones that are in Philadelphia, but so much of our programming now is about what it is like to live and the different realities we each wake up to in the morning. So yes, a lot of the programs that come through our website and our kind of our listserv seem rarefied, but I don't think of the organization as that in a way. And I'm worried, I guess, again, not to say that this is what you were saying, but it was really interesting at the Creative Time Summit that NATO had organized in New York a few weeks back. I don't know, there had been this accusation that I'd heard from after a presentation that I and others had given that we were privileged, that we were somehow kind of very privileged, the discourse that we're introducing and that we're articulating. And I guess I don't think that way, because if you think that somebody's privileged and somebody's not privileged, then you reinstate hierarchies. And I just think very differently about the world and about conversation. And I just don't want to create those hierarchies. I don't know that we need to reproduce them in a way. So I don't know if I'm answering the question, but I just, you know, I have a different way of thinking.
This is why I love talking with Aaron. It's really nice to talk to you, and we're not both really exhausted. You're exhausted because you just came back from. So that's good. But we're always talking about accepting privilege, mm-hmm. right? And we don't call it privilege. We talk about how to live out of abundance rather than scarcity. You know, how to figure a model that's living instead of saying less than, or we don't have it. How do you open that up? And how do we treat each other and the work as if it matters? In a society where often art conversations are not privileged, are not respected, and particularly art forms that aren't the art forms that are heavily capitalized or that are not respected. And one of the things I love about what Aaron does is I use it as an inspiration for confidence. you know, to say, because of course it's so funny, Eric, that you say, I don't think of us having privileged discourse. Eric, privileged discourse. Maybe you've got to change up. But I'm going to take that back to the office, and I'm going to say, listen, what we're doing is we're having privileged discourse. Do you understand that's what you're saying? Right? And it does. And then people sort of sit up and they say, oh, yeah, that's what we're doing. Yeah, we're privileged discourse. That's true. It's beautiful to accept the privilege, because it is privilege. We're having this conversation because they have lights, they have heat, they have this crazy, gorgeous mirror. This is a privilege.
No. Like, you know, Peace Project. So we were talking to people, and people thought that peace is like, it's a privilege. No, it's a human right. Like,
conversation is a human right.
Dialogue is not like a privilege.
It's a right, but we have been privileged to live it. This is fat. That juicy gravy privilege that we don't have bombs. This is we got to accept it. And I think part of what drives me, and I think part of what drives you, is knowing. I don't want to speak because you'll slam me about it. But is saying I don't want to waste this privilege. I don't want to have all of this gorgeous, you know, these people. Everybody got here. Everybody has transportation home. I'm going west if you don't, but not too far west. We only have two. But we have all of it, and not to piss it away. I think that's part of what drives me, is that we do have it.
Yeah, but, I mean, Megan and others know this. I mean, Philly is my home, and Philly is my base. I live here. It's been well over 15 years now. But it's really tough coming back on each of these last trips. I don't know how to talk about what you're talking about here. It's easy to talk about it in Beijing. It's easy to talk about it in Pakistan. It's not easy to talk about this here. People have their heads in the sand. And I don't know. There's a part of me which kind of comes back 2 days ago, and I just want to leave the next day. It's very hard to know how one talks about these issues. In America at this moment. So I don't know if I'm making sense or not. But
where'd you grow up, Aaron?
In New York.
In New York?
Yeah. I'm the children of activists had to struggle with paying their kids through college and things like this.
How come we get to keep you in Philadelphia? I love it.
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, man, come on, don't go back to New York. They don't need you, we do.
I'm not going to New York.
The hell with them.
I'm here,
is
I'm just...
a child gone to the curse again?
It's a tough moment in America.
Yeah.
It's been tough for decades.
Yeah, it's been.
But there's there's been a disinvestment in Philadelphia in particular for decades now. And cultural organizations are the only thing left to rebuild a civil society that's been dismantled, at least as I see it. And it's not necessarily getting any better.
I think there's some sports organizations that are doing the same thing, by the way. No, I think with kids' sports are doing some of the same things. I really think they're doing some of it. I wish we could do sports and arts together. Like London's whole cultural project that had sports and arts together in its cultural strategic plan. Because I think body and mind, you know, I wish we could do that. And that's a boundary I'd love to. Yeah. Are we doing another question? Or comment or something?
I'll ask a question.
Oh, hello.
Just at the time, just so maybe you'll get one.
All right.
Considering that we're here in the Chitad Larka room, and Chitad Larka was started in 1998, I mean, the Ramon Pistoletto Arts Center was started in 1998 by you, and Slot was started in 2002 by Anza. One question that came up when we were discussing Chitad Larka was, what is the future of an organization that was started by one individual? Yeah. Or by an individual vision? And what happens when, you know, that individual is no longer part of it, or, you know, no longer there? And what is the future of your organization beyond what you're doing? And I think you touched a little bit on it already, so maybe you can, you know, talk a little more about it and think that you're...
I think it matters very much what the vision for the organization was, and I don't think everything has to go on forever and ever. Some things are meant to be, and the fact is we only have today. I mean, always, right? But some organizations, and I think if an organization is about the program, then it works in that program, in that moment, and comes to closure accordingly. If an organization is about building an institution, then you do otherwise. So we have a 3-year strategic plan. We had a Wednesday meeting with our succession transition consultant, also paid for by William Penn. We have, and I am going to, I'm talking about this. Of course, we're supposed to hire somebody to do proper messaging of all this stuff. But I'm going to leave the organization in 2012. Our board knows that. We have a 3-year plan for it. We have a timetable. We have this happens in January. This happens in February. This happened. We're on target and we're doing it. We got the building so that we would have the place. We're putting money into a prudent cash reserve. We have a little teeny little tiny, 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 tiny little, it's like a little baby penis of an endowment. You know when they little one they pee at you? That's what our endowment is when it looks. But it's something, you know. It's been peeing on it. It doesn't even get up to you. It just kind of. But we're trying to get it.
Block that metaphor.
Sorry, I started it. I'm so sorry. But that's what we're trying to do. We have a place, prudent cash reserve, endowment, good board that's able to have some reach, good staff. We just this week put on a staff person who I think will be staffed up, larger group of volunteers. I mean, it's just like that. It's a business. So that's what we're trying to do.
I mean, it would be a luxury to be at that. Is this on? No. Hello? Yes?
Well, that's okay. The end of the thing here. Take my...
Okay.
There you go.
I mean, it'd be a luxury to be at that point where we could really imagine the organization so easily sustaining and transitioning to another person. I'd like us to be there. I'd like us to get there. And I think it'd be a great thing for the organization to be redefined in turn by somebody else and by others. I guess I'm not interested in critiquing Pistoletta's project. I don't think it's constructive to critique other people's cultural and social initiatives in that way. But I don't know, I guess if I were to just make a small critique, I wouldn't put my face on the book of my projects. And I guess there's an ethic. There's an ethic to how you conduct yourself as a leader of a cultural organization, as a founder, without making the organization be about you or, you know, mm-hmm, entirely mm-hmm. reducible to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a really delicate issue.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, I struggle with that. But I guess his model is not my model. And I understand that he came out of the 60s and 70s. I understand why it is that he positions himself so visibly. But that wouldn't be the way that I would do it. So I would welcome that moment when we could transition and hopefully can. You know, we've also, this past year, done a strategic plan. We've done a needs assessment. We've been doing all that work towards that end, but it's still so far from where we are.
Well, no.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming. I think we're going to end on this note.
Thank you.
And I just want to remind you all that the last conversation in the series happening on January 14th, and we're having Felix Day and Zoe Strauss.
Oh, Zoe Strauss, yay! Great.
And please join me too in thanking Maureen and Aaron.
Thank you.